This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Okay, now that's more like it. 151,000 new jobs last month. Of course, today's unemployment report isn't the whole answer to what ails the American economy, but boy, I'll tell you, it sure helps. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com. And by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 5th of November. Glad to have you with us. What we have with today's October unemployment report, almost three full years after the economy started losing jobs, is what you can safely call sustained, although modest, job growth at private companies. As I said, 151,000 new jobs in October, nearly all of them in the private sector. The unemployment rate didn't budge, though, still 9.6%, and that number might not go down for a while because of the huge backlog of people still out there looking for work. Although job growth over the past several months has come in better than a lot of people were expecting, the story of this morning's report is hiring and how companies are still kind of leery about it. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Since midsummer, private companies have been hiring more than 100,000 new employees a month. Economist Gary Bertlis at the Brookings Institution says that's good as far as it goes.
It's still very moderate job growth overall. It's about what is needed to keep us from sinking into a deeper hole.
There are still millions of people laid off in the recession who aren't finding their way back to work. And many of those who are coming back as temps. Last month, one out of five new jobs was temporary.
Well, we currently have three full-time employees, and the position we just hired was a driver.
Matt Edgar owns Liberty Fleet Services, a flatbed rental company in Houston. He hired that worker as a temp when business started to pick up this summer.
He fit really well, and in October we thought we could add another person, so we did.
A full-time person, and that's just how the temp-to-permanent job model is supposed to work. Problem is, says Gary Bertlis, it's not working that way often enough.
Hiring a temporary worker instead of a full-time permanent worker is usually a cheaper alternative that doesn't commit you to as much future cost.
Some employers are ready to commit, though, especially in fields like healthcare and technology, where growth has been strong.
I kind of have a feeling that it's now or never for my company.
Jeff Gale has 20 employees at his Birmingham, Alabama company that handles online ticket sales. He'll hire eight more by early next year. Competitors are growing and snapping up talent, so Gale says he has to do so as well. Sam Blackman of Elemental Technologies, a video software company in Portland, Oregon, feels the same way.
We can hire tremendous people that we may not have access to in a normal, strong economy and at very reasonable compensation.
And at least for a while, they shouldn't be too hard to find. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The mechanics of what the Federal Reserve did earlier this week, that thing where it's going to pump $600 billion into the economy, the mechanics are actually pretty simple. The Fed goes out and it buys lots and lots of government bonds. That pushes interest rates down for banks and eventually consumers and companies, too. It's really cheap right now for companies to borrow money, and they have been all week. Now, if they'd only actually spend it. From New York, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
When the federal government pushes interest rates really low, it's basically calling on companies to borrow. The day after the Fed's announcement, companies like Coke and General Electric raced to issue more than $12 billion in corporate bonds. NYU economist Lawrence White.
If you can lock in a low interest rate, that means you've reduced your costs, and that gives you more surplus that you can use to reinvest in the company.
The Fed wants companies to take that cheap money and expand and hire people. But Conference Board economist Kathy Bosjancic says that won't happen if businesses are worried about the economy.
If they think the consumer's going to stay soft, companies aren't going to expand because the demand just won't be there.
Companies have said they'll use the cheap money to pay off more expensive debt and buy shares of their own stock. NYU's Lawrence White says that's not enough to help the economy.
There's nothing wrong with repaying a higher cost debt. You know, that's a legitimate use for this kind of borrowing. But by itself, that doesn't generate more jobs for the economy.
2 years ago, the Fed bought nearly $2 trillion worth of bonds. Companies borrowed billions and sat on it. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, higher, barely. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I don't think you're going to find too many weeks with more economic news than this, a national election that turned on our finances, the Federal Reserve jumping back into the economy in a very big way, and then today's jobs numbers. It's a lineup tailor-made for a look back. So that's what we're going to do. Our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond with Felix Salmon from Reuters and Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Lee, Felix, good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Great to be here.
So I saw a great tweet this morning. They were talking about the jobs numbers, and they said, wow, boy, those Republicans sure work fast, man.
It was astonishing. Days.
So here's the substantive question,
hours,
though.
Seconds.
That's right. Republicans now have 2 years to turn the economy around, the same 2 years that President Obama and the democratically controlled Congress have. Felix, is 2 years enough time to fix anything?
Well, clearly they've done it in 2 days, right?
Boom, boom,
we
yes.
have 151,000 new people in work that weren't in work last month. So
that'd be a no then, right?
That would be a no. The economy is in pretty dreadful shape. Everyone was concentrating about the payrolls numbers, but actually the unemployment figures just were completely static. They didn't budge. They're incredibly high. And if the Republicans think that they're going to somehow manage to make a change to that situation, they're delusional.
Well, wait a second, Lee. What about the thought that businesses like to know what's coming and that a divided government in Congress will let businesses know there will not be too many new regulations, everything will be the same as it was, and thus it will get better?
There's definitely truth to that. I mean, business likes certainty. That's why they just like the election being over with. But getting back to the first point, even if 2 years was enough, they're kind of coming in with a head start. I mean, if things are starting to recover now, which I do think they are, and I think they started a couple months ago, they certainly have the potential to take credit of a lot of work that was done beforehand.
Well, let me ask you this then, Felix. If jobs are the measure of progress in the economy, which they have sort of become, and if unemployment is going to be high for the foreseeable future, which a lot of people say it will, what's the measure of success?
The measure of success is the unemployment rate. Right now, it's at 9.6%. It's been over 9.5% for 14 of the 20 months that Barack Obama has been president. And unless and until that gets down to something vaguely sane, and I'm thinking, you know, 7 point something percent, we are not going to feel as though we have a vibrant, successful economy, and we're going to have way too many people out of work.
So even in 2 years, Lee, when the economy is still growing slowly as it has been, but unemployment is 8-ish, I don't know, let's pick a number, people still won't feel satisfied.
I don't know. That's a really good question. I mean, I think getting down below the 9 figure would probably have some sort of psychological reaction. And don't forget, the market is very, very susceptible to psychological reactions. But the recovery itself is going to be very, very, very slow. You know, it could take a while.
Felix, let me turn very quickly to the Federal Reserve. Ben Bernanke, $600 billion in this thing they call quantitative easing, driving down interest rates, getting things going that way. Is it going to work?
No, it's not going to work. It has a very marginal effect. It's basically moving money around from treasuries to agencies. The Federal Reserve is buying treasury bonds, and the people who used to own treasury bonds are now buying agencies, or maybe they're buying stocks. It doesn't matter. But what we're talking about is all confined to the markets, and the chances of it having any noticeable effect in the real economy are pretty slim.
Lee Gallagher, Ben Bernanke, hero or goat? Come on.
I say hero. Look, I mean, you know, I'm not saying this is going to be the magic wand. The Fed doesn't have the magic wand that everybody thinks it has. But, you know, I think Bernanke is a fan of stimulus, and he saw the gridlock coming, and I think he saw this, as has been said, his Hail Mary. It just so happens that we might not have needed it after all.
Yeah, based on your theory that the economy is going to keep growing now because it's already started, right?
Yes.
Okay. What does it say, though? Well, I just want to iron that out. What does it say, though, Lee, that the chairman of the Fed, after having made this big quantitative easing announcement in Fed bureaucracies on Wednesday afternoon, felt the need to put an op-ed in the Washington Post explaining himself to the American public?
You know, he feels this resistance. There was a lot of resistance to this round. Just, I mean, the Fed has already bought $1.75 trillion worth of bonds. So, you know, he has to really defend himself at this point.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, Felix Salmon at Reuters. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
Given that we're just now getting out of a recession that really took a chunk out of worldwide consumer demand, Oxford Street in central London has an enviable problem. It's Europe's busiest shopping district, 200 million people a year, $10 billion in consumer spending. But all that commercial success has caused a physical problem, too many people in not enough space, which has in turn forced a creative solution. From Oxford Street Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
It's 4 o'clock on a weekday afternoon, and the sidewalk here is packed with hundreds of pedestrians. But, says Jace Tyrrell of the new West End company, take a closer look at the heaving mass, and you see two quite distinct kinds of people. First, there are the dawdlers.
It's those that want to go slow, they want to look at the windows, come in and out of the shops, have a bit more of a leisurely experience, probably more our tourists that come here.
But they tend to get in the way of the second type of pedestrian.
Perhaps those that live in London, work in London, particularly in the West End, know where they're going with intent, often with purpose. They want to be fast, moving quickly.
The obvious solution, says Jace, is to paint a line down the middle of the sidewalk, dividing it in two, with a slow lane next to the shop windows and a fast lane next to the road. Many pedestrians seem to approve.
Yes, I should think it's probably quite a good idea because there is so much pedestrian traffic along here now.
Everybody's bumping into it. I mean, I stand here and I get umbrellas in my face. I get everything because I'm forever bumping into people or people bumping into me. So, yeah, I think that's a good idea.
But enthusiasm for the plan tends to falter when it comes to enforcement. One idea is for the street to be patrolled by wardens with on-the-spot fines for dawdlers who stray into the fast lane and fail to reach the minimum speed of 3 miles an hour. That has provoked the ire of one of Britain's most venerable lobby groups.
Well, we're the national charity in the UK that campaigns for the rights of pedestrians.
Including the inalienable right to walk on any part of the sidewalk at whatever speed you choose. Tony Armstrong of the Pedestrian Society, recently renamed Living Streets, takes a dim view of the two-speed approach.
Crazy, you know, this solution is, you know, making a freeway for pedestrians is just really a crazy idea because it's unenforceable and it really doesn't address the root problem that we have on the street.
And the root problem, according to the pedestrian lobby, is not the dawdlers or the speed walkers. It's the road traffic. It's calling for a total ban on vehicles in Oxford Street. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up,
art is part of the business of survival.
Bringing beauty from chaos in Haiti. But first, let's do the numbers. Yes, this is where the music you might have heard on another public radio program this morning really belongs. But we will take the imitation as flattery and tell you that profit-taking threatened early, but a late surge kept Wall Street's five-week rally alive. The Dow Industrials bumped up 9 points, almost 0.1%. Closed at 11,444, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ up a point, less than 0.1%. 25.78. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.4%. Ended things at 12.25. For the week gone by, the Dow and the NASDAQ both ticked up 2.9%. The S&P 500 rose 3.6%. Financial stocks posted strong gains today on reports that the Fed may let them boost dividends. Citigroup socked away a gain of 3.7%. Morgan Stanley booked 3.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 2.8% on this Friday. Kraft Foods was a drag on the Dow. It fell 2.2% today after reporting that higher prices had hurt sales. A further blow might lose a deal to distribute Starbucks coffee. Starbucks shares percolated up 3.75% on growth prospects today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Avoid tragedy. Set your clock back over the weekend so you don't show up to work early. In case you've missed the hype, Conan premieres, Conan O'Brien's late night talk show. And on November 8th, 1889, the Treasure State became the 41st state in the Union. That would be Montana. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. After a quick turn in the Rose Garden this morning to talk about those jobs numbers, President Obama left for a 10-day swing through Asia. He'll hit India tomorrow and then Indonesia, South Korea, and Japan. Trade between India and the U.S. is set to reach about $40 billion this year. That would be an all-time high, as Raymond Thibodeau reports now from New Delhi.
Music and fireworks kick off the Indian holiday of Diwali, a five-day celebration when Indians shower each other with gifts. It seems apt that President Obama visits during the festival when Indians are in a generous mood. His message? Give us more of your business and give us better access to your markets so we can create more jobs back in the U.S. President Obama's first stop is Mumbai, India's commercial capital. Joining him are more than 200 American entrepreneurs and corporate CEOs. GE and Boeing are here to speed up contracts for planes and heavy equipment to India, worth about $8 billion. Satyajit Banerjee is director for the Confederation of Indian Industry. He says the U.S. is getting the short end of the stick when it comes to trade with India, but not by much, and not for much longer.
The opportunities that are coming in the defense sector and the types of opportunities that American goods and services will see in India is immense.
Still, he says many Indians are miffed that the U.S. is trying to protect its own markets. Higher visa fees for Indians working in the U.S. and tax breaks to American companies that create jobs at home rather than abroad haven't exactly played well in India. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Hurricane Thomas is delivering yet more trouble to Haiti today. Officials in Port-au-Prince say three people have died in the storm. It's just the latest in a year of tragedies for the country. There was, of course, January's devastating earthquake, the recent cholera outbreak a couple of weeks ago as well. Haitian-born novelist Edwige Dantica lives in New York City now, and her new book, Create Dangerously, is about that life as an immigrant and an expatriate writer, and what it's like to make art out of a country in chaos. So today on our series, The Art of Money, what artists and others see when they look at the economy, the culture of Haiti, its music, its literature, its paintings, and what all of that means to the Haitian people and how they get by. When we spoke, I asked Edwige Dantica to describe what it's like when people see Haiti for the first time.
You know, when you take a group of students and they get there at the airport, it's almost suddenly it's technicolor because it's art everywhere. The tap-taps, the transportation.
The little buses.
Yeah. All covered in, they were like moving paintings, the lotto stands, the beauty shop stands. And all of that almost as if to contrast and to fight for beauty in a place that there is often some sadness.
Yeah, well, about that sadness, you know, there is a strong element in this book of using the arts to get around the sadness of Haitian politics, back in the days of the Duvaliers and the political killings, and how art was an escape for you.
Absolutely, because one of the ways that I think a lot of Haitian artists over generations have created dangerously, if you will, is that they've developed a sense of marronnage by seeming to talk about one thing, whether it's in song or in music or in literature, but actually talking about more than that. So part of the arts is also a sense of self-protection, which I think adds to the nuance of whatever form of expression that it is.
Is it also a way to take yourself away from the poverty and the struggle of daily life sometimes in Haiti?
It's a way of escape, and it's a way of saying, you know, this is not all we are, being poor, being desperate, as we're often seen. There's also this soul there, this capacity to create something beautiful. Because also, I mean, Haitian artists are great masters of collage because people take, for example, these oil drums and make beautiful metal sculptures out of them. They take these carnation milk cans and make these beautiful painted lamps. And everything is recycled for art, but also for daily use.
It has been, at various points in Haiti's history, dangerous to express yourself either in the spoken word or the written word or in visual arts. How does that legacy affect you today?
It makes me grateful for being able to do the work that I'm doing because often being a writer, I think especially if, as a first, second generation immigrant, is a privilege, first of all, economically, because I'm only able to have the luxury of it because my parents, they worked hard. They were so busy in the business of survival. So it makes me grateful for the opportunity that I've been given both to have my work now freely read in Haiti and also here.
I want to pick up on something you just said, the business of survival. How do people in Haiti have the time for the expression of themselves that comes out in their art when survival there can be so hard?
Art is part of the business of survival, and it's one of the things that people know that they can share with the world. It's almost one of the few guaranteed businesses. No matter what the time is, there will always be on the road to the airport or wherever you go in front of the hotels. Art has become, in terms of what we export, one of the things that has sustained the country financially.
You've been back since the earthquake a number of times, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the first time.
Well, that first trip back was a couple of weeks after the earthquake. We had lost two family members, and, you know, we were gathering lists of what different family members needed. And one of the hardest things about it was to just go through all these places where I had gone to school, where I had gone to church, and to see that they had crumbled. And part of that was just to see the vanishing. But another thing, too, was just the strength of people. And I've seen that in many different trips after that.
You lost a cousin, right? Max, mm-hmm. Maxo?
My cousin Maxo, yes.
Yeah.
And his 10-year-old son.
I wonder if I could get you actually to read something for me. It's out of the last chapter of this book about the earthquake. You call that chapter Our Guernica, mm-hmm. after the very famous painting. It's right there on page 162.
From now on, there will always be the Haiti of before the earthquake and the Haiti of after the earthquake. And after the earthquake, the way we read and the way we write, both inside of outside of Haiti, will never be the same. Daring again to speak for the collective, I will venture to say that perhaps we will write with the same fervor and intensity, or even more, as before. Perhaps we will write with the same sense of fearlessness or hope. Perhaps we will continue to create as dangerously as possible. But our muse has been irreparably altered. Our people, both inside and outside of Haiti, have changed. In ways that I'm not yet fully capable of describing, we artists, too, have changed.
Edwige Dantica, her new book, Create Dangerously, about Haiti and her experiences there and here in the United States as well. Edwige, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We have an excerpt of Create Dangerously by Edwige Dantica on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. By Constant Contact, helping small businesses and nonprofits make sense of social media. You can learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. And by Putnam Investments, you can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America, or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to end the week of Friday, finally after five busy days. So what if we take a break from the big news and see what didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Noonan, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Avishai Artsy, assistant producer, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
It's about two rabbits, Kathy and Miffy.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah, well, it's actually kind of contentious. Miffy is this well-known Dutch children's book character, Rabbit, and the creator has sued Sanrio, the Japanese company behind Hello Kitty, because they have a character named Kathy that looks a lot like Miffy.
So it's Rabbit versus Rabbit. Who won?
Miffy won. Kathy can no longer be sold in the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg.
So Miffy's next book is going to be called Miffy Crushes Her Enemies Using All Legal Means at Her Disposal.
Yeah, parental guidance strongly recommended.
Adrian Hill, sustainability reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, it turns out we're painting our wind turbines, our big windmills, the wrong color.
Wait, they're white, the color of clouds. It seems perfect.
It does seem perfect, but the white, the color of clouds, also attracts bugs, which attracts bats and birds, which then get killed by the windmills.
Oh, that's right. The birds get butchered in the windmills.
Very sad. So instead, it turns out we should be painting these things purple.
Purple windmill sounds like a Lucky Charm marshmallow.
Delassie Michalis, web developer, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, a bunch of Brooklyn fashion designers are going to be staging a show pretty soon, and they're going to be using the nutria, the fur of the nutria, which is this giant rodent that's been overrunning Louisiana.
So that's a nice way of saying they're going to make clothes out of rat fur.
Clothes and capes and wraps and shawls and I think even a fur-lined wedding dress.
This is like the ultimate anti-PETA fur, you realize. Because nothing a protester could throw on it would be more disturbing than the actual clothes.
That's true.
Like, oh, you threw blood on me? I'm wearing a rat.
There is, believe it or not, oh, so much more where that came from. It's a podcast called Dinner Party Download that Brendan and Rico do. The link, of course, is on our website. It's marketplace.org. And on this Friday afternoon, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up, about 9 points, almost 0.1%. The NASDAQ up a point, gained less than 0.1%. The S&P 500 rose 4 points, 0.4%. All three major indices, though, up for the week. That's a five-week rally, if you're counting. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy by the name of J.J. Ewell. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. So listen, does life ever make you feel like you're stuck between a rock and a hard place?
I do feel myself pulled in two directions. My parents were very good to my sister and me, and my sons need a mother.
It's the sandwich generation. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here, same bat time, same bat channel on Monday.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.